And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Does insane noise equal progress? But we're not going to discuss that in this program. That's for some other discussion. Today we have some information for you, and first thing I want to do is remind you, as I always do, to check in on our Facebook page. We have some very lively debates going on the Facebook page. The main one lately is between a listener to the show and somebody who frequently writes in, and myself on the whole idea of third-party voting and the whole idea of voting for either one of these two parties that own and run the country. So check in with the Facebook page at all times, but especially catch this debate. And later on, we're going to talk more about that subject. You can go to Google Facebook and Occupied Territory, or on the PRN.FM station you're listening, go to the Occupied Territory homepage, and you can get onto the Facebook page that way. So a bunch of things to talk about. We'll be back in just a little bit. All right, Occupied Territory here with Mike Fader, and once again, the Facebook page, Occupied Territory, and tune and listen to the podcast that we have. In the next couple of weeks, we'll have guests. One guest will be from a group that is leading some of the protests, or will be leading some of the protests if they don't lock them up, at the Republican National Convention in Tampa. And as I've mentioned before in this program, the Department of Homeland Security has given tens of millions of dollars. The federal government is using your tax money to give tens of millions of dollars to the Tampa Police Department, who will be hiring thousands of extra police officers who don't even live in Tampa, and private security guards to protect the Republicans against the public. How do you feel about that? Do we all feel really good that our tax money is going from the federal government without us having any say over it to give weapons that are used generally in military campaigns, flashbang grenades, sound blasters, drones, other surveillance equipment, something that almost looked like armored personnel carriers, practically tanks, to the Tampa Police Department and the state police to keep people from protesting and to keep protesters away from people who were supposed to be involved in a democratic process, but are not at all. And this also, Department of Homeland Security has given tens of millions of dollars to the Charlotte Police Department, where the Democrats will be having their convention to see who is president. Of course, we all know who it's going to be because the fix is always in. And that'll be in early September. Also, they're spending your tax money on protecting the Democrats at the convention and the president who is running for president of the United States from you, from its own citizens. Is there something wrong with this picture? Well, I don't know if people even can feel it anymore. You're so numbed by the theft of our democracy and by the despair which has been injected to us every day by the behavior of the president and the people running for president and all the money, it's hard to tell. The way I look at it is this, and you can get involved in this debate when you go to the Occupied Territory Facebook page. The way I look at it is this. It's more as if the corporate states of America, used to be called, the CSA was the Confederate States of America. Now, call it the corporate states of America or the United Corporation States of America, are having their annual shareholders meetings in August and in September. And then they're having the larger shareholder meeting in November. The early shareholder meetings are called political conventions, and the big shareholder meeting to pick the CEO of the United Corporations of America is in November. It's otherwise, or it used to be known as Election Day. It's not Election Day anymore. We don't have Election Day We're not electing anything. That implies an actual choice. That implies that you have some say in how your country works, what it does with the taxes it takes away from you, how it treats you, how it treats other people abroad in your name. You don't have any influence anymore over that. Not through your congressperson, not through your senator, and absolutely not through the president of the United States. So really, Obama and Romney are running, and most corporations, you can read about this on Financial Pages and other places, there is a nascent shareholders' rights movement in the United States, where little by little, a few angry shareholders of companies are sick and tired of their companies either not doing well or doing badly or cheating on taxes because some of them have moral feelings, the people who are angry. And they won't, they stand up at shareholder meetings, although they have no power at all. I mean, God forbid that if you own part of a company that you should have any power over what that company does. If it wants to pollute the Arctic or corrupt governments or hire the actual armies of other countries like Chevron in Nigeria to kill people who get in their way, you have no say over that if you have a share in their company. What does it mean you have a share in their company? It means maybe you get a dividend, means you can sell the stock, but you have no control over it. Well, the same thing has now happened in what used to be called the United States of America. It's basically a gigantic shareholders meeting in which you have no power in November. And it was once called Election Day, and to the extent that we had some control over our government, it actually meant something. But it hardly means anything anymore. And there is no doubt in my mind. I've been reflecting on this. I've read books on this. I've had arguments with people. I've been thinking about this for a long time. I will no longer vote for the lesser of two evils. I am tired of voting for the lesser of two evils. When you vote for the lesser of two evils, you inevitably, you can't help it, become part of the whole evil process. Now, evil is a pregnant, you know, overloaded, much overused word. And, you know, I don't really mean evil. What's evil? The devil? Is this a Dan Brown novel? By the way, is there a worse writer in the world than Dan Brown? What's the name of that book that he that 400 million people sold? What's it called? I can't remember either, right? Because the Da Vinci Code. I thought that John Grisham was a bad one. Now, John Grisham, by the way, it's interesting, is a great story. Pardon the diversion here. This happens to me. John Grisham is a great storyteller, and he's an intelligent, interesting, decent guy. I don't know anything about Dan Brown, but John Grisham is already Shakespeare compared to Dan Brown. I picked up the Da Vinci Code one day when I was feeling very depressed and couldn't eat, you know, or I needed something to, like, you know, to occupy my hands so I didn't strangle somebody. And I picked up the Da Vinci Code. It was a paperback. I read two pages of this book and threw it across the room, got 2 points, right into the trash can. That is the worst book I've ever read. Anyhow, back where we were. So basically, evil, I don't know. The use of the word evil gets people irritated, and it should, I suppose, because evil, what, is used by the Catholic Church. It's used by religions and priests and rabbis and imams to scare the living crap out of you, so you do whatever the nutty thing it is that they tell you to believe. You know, that you're supposed to believe in hell, there's a devil. You know what? Actually, there is a hell, and guess what? We're in it. It's called the modern world on Earth. You don't have to worry about going to a worse place. Really, there is no worse place, and there could be no better place. There could be heaven too, if we could achieve it. But that's the way it goes. So, forget about the word evil. But I'm tired, let's say, of voting for the lesser of two corporate stooges or two corporate executives, however much influence they have over which corporations are telling them what to do at any given time. Romney is clearly, to the extent he's not actually an android constructed by space creatures, he is clearly a creature of corporations so thoroughly that he has actually almost been built by corporations, you know, to be the president. He is he's like the Manchurian candidate for corporations, pretending to be a human, but actually, I don't know what he is. I mean, he is really something. And anybody who votes for George Romney is only voting for him, I think, because they hate Obama, for whatever reason. Anything from racism, and there's a whole lot of people will vote against Obama because he's black, right, to the fact that he's a quote-unquote liberal, to the extent that anybody understands what that means anymore, but he's not a liberal. So the point here is that you don't really have a choice. You think you have a choice, but you don't. And sadly, the same thing goes for most congressional candidates and almost every last senatorial candidate. Don't forget, Bernie Sanders is an independent. He's a socialist. He's not a member of the Democratic or Republican Party. He couldn't be, right? And Kucinich is not around anymore, and Feingold is not around anymore. There's nobody to vote for. They are all already bought and sold. The fix is in. Now, a lot of people will say, and this is part of the argument that goes on here, look what the Tea Party, we need to do what the Tea Party people did. Reform. Start at the grassroots and reform the Democratic Party, right? It's our only hope. Help me, Obi-Wan, it's our only hope. Oh, really? Give up all hope, ye who enter the political process with two parties. If you can't reform, the Tea Party people never reformed the Republican Party. All they did was slow it down and ossify it to the point of more rigidity, and they dragged down the level of intelligence even more than it was before. So the Republican Party needed their votes. They made a pact with the non-existent devil, and that is the Tea Party people. And now they have become completely inoperable, totally stupid, and utterly useless as a political party. Democratic Party is more like a kind of a crippled, fatally ill entity, which is trying occasionally with its last gasp to reach up and do something worthwhile here and there. The Republican Party is dead as a doornail, and partly because they kept making a deal. See, this is what happens. It's like an endless hall of mirrors. The Republican Party decided to keep making compromises and bargains. John McCain, who is a loony, rich, insensitive, jerk, he picks Sarah Palin, who has, you know, lowered the bar to the point where the bar is now lying on the ground. So he compromised with this whole religious fundamentalist, stupid, ignorant, bigoted, brainless group of people in his own party to get votes, and this is what you got. So we're going lower and lower and lower. We are devolving as an intelligent species. You know, we're devolving as a democracy. So when you vote, so the Republican Party, it keeps making deals and chooses, the lesser and lesser and lesser of two evils. And they're totally, you know, screwed up now. Point being, there is no sense. And I want to tell you, I've had many dialogues. The show is called Occupied Territory. And my main feeling is that just as in the 30s, which happened very often, and again in around the turn of the 19th, 20th century, there was a gigantic populist movement where people either, poor, to talk about guns, but this is a separate issue, farmers armed themselves and wouldn't let banks take away their houses because they were being, treated like they were, vermin, and the banks were coyotes, just like usual. But basically, there were these giant movements in the country, populist movement. There was a huge movement in the 30s. People were, starving to death, had no place to live, worse than even now, much worse. And there were close to estimated million members, or people who would go to, at least frequently, of the Communist Party or Communist Party, meetings, and who signed pamphlets and who joined the Communist Party. Now, you adjust that for inflation, we're talking about something like 5 to 8 million people, adult voting people, who would march in parades, go to meetings, join the party, and who were sympathetic to the Communist Party to the point where they considered voting for candidates that ran that way, or socialist candidates. You're talking about several million voters right now. Can you imagine that? Several million voters. And these people took to the streets. They didn't believe in reforming the Democratic Party. They threatened the Democratic Party. They said, if you don't start doing things for the people instead of just rich people, as you always seem to be doing unless we stop you, we are going to split away from you and form our own party and start running people for office, and you will start losing all your strength and maybe not exist anymore. And the Democratic Party heard what they said. They were afraid of a revolution in the 30s, and they moved way on over to the left, which is to say, to do the right thing. Social Security. They took care of old people when they got old, people who worked hard all their lives. They took care of people who were sick, home relief. They imposed taxes on people. They hired people by the millions who were starving and gave them decent work so they could have a sense of pride and honor in themselves and paid them something. To fix highways, to build post offices. Can you even imagine that? It sounds like science fiction now. So this happened in the 30s. And this happened because people threatened the Democratic Party. They stepped outside of the Democratic Party and said, you've had it. We're not voting for you anymore. Our vote is a joke. You've treated it as a joke. You've slapped us in the face. You take our money away. You let the banks do what they want. We're not putting up with it anymore. Democratic Party heard that, tried to prevent a revolution, and did by doing somewhat the right thing. Same thing in the 60s. There would be no advances in civil rights. There would be no, we'd still be in Vietnam if people hadn't taken to the streets. Whatever it would be. This would be like the 40th anniversary of the Vietnam War or the 50th anniversary. We'd still be there, right? We'd be feeding, young people. There would be a draft and we'd be feeding people into the machine until there was nobody left in this country. And people took to the streets. They paid for it. They got arrested in the thousands, in the tens of thousands in demonstrations, civil rights demonstrators, gay rights, women's rights, all of this in the 60s and 70s, not through the Democratic Party, but in spite of and around them, like a vast river that couldn't be stopped, that sort of swept them away in the right direction. And that's what has to happen now. That's why this show is here. This is not... this is not Democratic Party radio like MSNBC is. There was one guy who was on TV who had a big audience, who was even remotely somebody who could be counted as an agent for change, who was not a hireling of the Democratic Party, like, unfortunately, all the people on MSNBC are. As nice as some of them are and as intelligent as they are and as hardworking and well-meaning as they may be, like Schultz, who I like, more than the others, they still basically are representatives of the Democratic Party. They also make several million dollars a year. Even Jon Stewart, who I love to watch, the only people who really go after, let me go back to what I was saying before. There was one guy, this is complicated, because of his vanity and greed and tremendous narcissism, Keith Olbermann has been thrown off or fired from two or three other major corporations and radio TV stations before, right? TV stations. Then he was on MSNBC. He was by far the best one on MSNBC. Why? Not just because he had so much personality or was so intelligent, which he was, but because he would go after anybody who he thought was hypocritical and anti-democratic, which included the President of the United States and the Democratic Party. He thought it was as much a joke and a shame and an embarrassment as what the Republicans were doing, and he said so, and he had a huge audience because of it. But then he got in trouble, and he switched over to this place called Current TV, and everybody watched him on there. He's the only major person on television with any substantial audience that routinely had people on from the Occupy movement and people who had been beaten up by cops and people from different Occupy encampments all over the country. He would have people on who were lawyers for the detainees at Guantanamo. He was the real thing, as close as you're going to get to a popular media person. Now, he quit Current TV because he's a narcissist and he's full of greed. And that's a damn shame, because he's the best that they had. He's the best we had, right? Now, we've got two comedy shows, Colbert, and we've got Jon Stewart. And Jon Stewart gets paid $14 million a year to make fun of hypocrisy and Republicans. And Colbert, who I like even better, who I think is sharper and smarter and takes more risks, gets paid something like $6 million a year. And... it's America. People, everybody wants to get rich, right? Apparently. So, but this is what they get paid to lacerate the rich. Jon Stewart, who makes $14 million a year, between the two of them, they make $20 million a year to eviscerate the rich on television. So we all laugh, and I laugh. I mean, they're the only people doing it, and they're smart, and they're funny, and they're sarcastic, and they go after the bad guys. But I'll tell you something interesting. Colbert, particularly, but and Jon Stewart too. they used to more or less keep it kind of balanced. In other words, they basically, of course, go after the Republicans and Fox News and places like that because truly they are the most ignorant, bigoted, dangerous people. So they're the better targets than the Democrats, right? But the Democrats are have crossed the line, and they are also corrupt. They're not as ignorant, and they're not as bigoted, but they are as corrupt now, and that includes the president and most of Congress. Well, Stewart and Colbert, especially Colbert, used to go after them. And but if you pay close attention, you will see, and I watch these clips every day. I don't watch the shows because they're after my bedtime. Yes, they are. They're after my bedtime. I can't stay up that late because by then, because I have to get up early and slop the hogs, I have to be in bed by 10. But I do watch the clips almost every single day of both shows, the best clips or numerous clips. And I love what they do. It makes me laugh. But by making you laugh, something really ironic and strange happens. Because they're there, we think that somebody is actually doing something. They're not politicians. They're not news people like Keith Olbermann was, or like the people on MSNBC are. They're not telling you, you know, they're not telling you, they're not reporting the news, they're not sending out reporters to places where it's even dangerous to go. They're not really revealing things, uncovering things, doing investigations. They're satirizing things. And good for them. I hope they keep doing. I like what they do. But the strange thing about that is that when they make you laugh, the danger is you'll get the feeling that something has actually happened or that something has changed. And it's a very subtle irony, right? I hope they stay on. I love watching them. But they don't do anything. They don't change anything. They'd like to. The only thing that happened, and this is what happened today, they went down to Washington after Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin had that gigantic teabagger, rally in Washington, whenever it was, a year ago or more. And they went down there and held their own rally. But basically, it's a comedy act. It's a gigantic stand-up act. And they're teetering on the edge of actual... Now, they can't take action. They can't make themselves news reporters. And they can't get that serious like Olbermann was, right? They can't do it. Why? Because they're comedians and they would lose their audience. And in fact, good for them. This is what their genius is at, especially Colbert. And I hope they keep doing it. And we need to have them. If you don't have satirists in a society, you don't even have a free society. Voltaire found that out when he started making fun of the French aristocracy. They threw him in prison, right? You, if you don't have an active, satirical, a bunch of satirical people like on websites or The Onion or people like Colbert or Stewart, once you start getting rid of those people or you shove them out of the way or give them no airspace, you are dead as a doornail. Unless you have people who are going to be able to demonstrate, who are going to be able to be sarcastic, to criticize, it's what all of our freedoms are based on, the ability to do that and the practice of it. So we've been having this debate on the Occupy Territory Facebook page about this. I have thought about it. I have reflected on it. Things have gone so far that there is no way that I would ever consider these two parties to be very much different. Once again, when November comes, they will open the doors of the polling places, and you as a shareholder in the United Corporations of America will go in there and you'll cast your shareholder vote for who the CEO is going to be. It'll be Mr. Obama or Mr. Romney to be the CEO of the United Corporations of America. You know what? I mean, the metaphors flow endlessly, right? Here's what I see it as a choice between. Let's say the United States of America is a prison. It's a prison of greed, meaninglessness, capitalism out of control, nascent fascism. We're in this giant prison here, and we've got a choice between two wardens and with their various deputy wardens and guards. One of the wardens smiles a lot, is more friendly, uses the word folks, and he will let you use the recreation yard more than the other warden. He'll also try to improve the quality of the food, and he will let you decorate your cell a little bit. And maybe you won't have to work quite as hard in the laundry or whatever it is you do in prison, right? The other guy, and that's Obama. The other guy running for warden of the prison that we all live in right now, whether we think we're free or not, is Romney. He'll take away one of your meals, so they only have two meals a day. He'll serve you garbage that's made, you know, outsourced to someplace overseas. He will make you work for private corporations, and there's a lot of that goes on anyhow, because half the prisons are owned by private corporations now, or they're being transferred to them. And he won't let you use the rec yard. If you die, he'll let you just rot where you are or throw you into an open grave. He won't even take you to the prison infirmary. Which warden do you want in your prison? It's up to you. That's the choice. Is that the only choice? No, there are other options. There are other options. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take a little break here, and then I'm going to come back with some more information about what this country is really like and how much it is really going to be completely privately owned. And then we'll make some more remarks on this. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back. Thank you. Okay, Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We're back again. With some articles from the newspaper here. This isn't a front page of the Times from, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, a week ago. It's always the same article anyhow. You know, this gigantic, you know, scandal, which we don't even know. We don't even know the depth of it. It's the ultimate scandal, and yet it's the most symbolic and the deepest, biggest, widest scandal. It's so big that there aren't enough Justice Departments in the world, or agents, or investigators to bring it down, unless we actually dismantle all the banks and nationalize all the banks. The only way to save the world and to save this country is to nationalize the banks. The president can declare a state of emergency. We're in a war, right? We're already in a permanent state of war. As part of that war, he can nationalize the banks. Otherwise, forget it. And this LIBOR scandal, which I can't get into the details of, A, because I don't have that much economic smarts. I could follow it for you. But basically, the banks have been rigging rates at which they loan and borrow money from each other and then set rates for other things like mortgages and student loans. They've been playing off you. They've been betting off you and lying to you. And this is every bank, every major bank in the entire world, right? And we're just beginning to find out about this. So do you think anything's going to come of this? I doubt it. But here's a typical headline, front page. U.S. is building criminal case in rate fixing. As regulators ramp up their global investigation into the manipulation of interest rates, this is that LIBOR scandal, the Justice Department has identified potential criminal wrongdoers by big banks and wrongdoing, rather, by big banks and individuals at the center of the scandal. Let's see. Now, some of these banks will be forced to settle. You love it when some gigantic banker or corporation murders hundreds of thousands of people, like the tobacco industry, millions of people, right? Or destroys the Gulf of Mexico and renders it impossible for marine or human life, destroys tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people's lives, their jobs, their livelihoods. A bank cheats people, a million mortgages or fake mortgages with phony, documents and everything else. And what does the government do? They settle with these companies, like a health insurance company or a bank or a pharmaceutical company. A pharmaceutical company sells a drug which they know will kill people or cause them to feel suicidal or homicidal. Who knows what this guy was taking, who shot those people out there. They will sell a drug like this, make billions of dollars in profit. Later on, it's revealed over and over again that the people in charge and the heads of research knew that it was a possibility, if not an actual likelihood, that there were side effects from this drug that could be poisonous or even fatal. And they sell it anyhow. And what happens? They get sued. BP gets sued. The Bank of America and J.P. Morgan get sued. And what happens? They settle with the government. They settle. They give them 1/10 or 1/50 of what their profit was in 1 year. And they get away literally with murder and wrecking the whole world's economy. Settle? All right, so the U.S. is building criminal cases and rate fixing. You tell me, raise your hand now, everybody who thinks that one single banker of these people, and this includes almost every bank in the world, major bank, that has actually destroyed the world's economy and gotten rich off you while you suffer, you tell me whether one single person is going to go to jail or not. I'll believe it when I see it, right? So, you know, imagine, and what happens, it settles over you is a kind of despair. And the Justice Department works for the President of the United States. He is the dictator-in-chief. He can tell the Justice Department who to go after, who to indict, what to do. He can hire more people for the Justice Department, investigators, auditors, economists, investigators for the FBI. He could put these people in jail. He could speed this whole thing up. There could be indictments. He could put these people in jail, Jamie Dimon and all the rest of them. They knew what was going on. They knew what was going on. Is he going to do it? No, he's not going to do it, because he's in the pay of these people, as bad as Romney ever would be. Let's see. It says here, the civil and criminal actions taken against these banks could cost the banking industry tens of billions of dollars. That is 1 year's profit at the most, maybe one quarter of a year's profit. Meaningless. Unless we nationalize the banks like yesterday, they're going to continue to grind us into dust. The main thing about the Occupy movement, why this show is called Occupied Territory, the main thing that Occupy was there to protest and there to show you was income inequality. Now, I'm not Karl Marx, and I don't even play Karl Marx on the radio, but it's, you know, for a long time I struggled against the whole idea of, like, everything is based on, you know, class, or everything is based on race, or everything is based on religion. Like, one thing will explain the ills and the benefits of the whole, of why we do everything and say everything, right? But the closest thing I ever came to, I must say, in my reading and my reflection, that really does seem to explain the inequality in the world and the misery of the world and wars and why so many people suffer is economics, is the fact that there are a small group of people in most countries, and certainly in this country now, more than ever before perhaps, that own almost everything. Listen to this. The Walton family that owns Walmart, the Walton family has $86 billion between them. Six people, catch this now, six people in the Walton family have as much wealth as the lower 48% of the American public has. 48% of the American public in the lower and lower middle and middle classes, all of their assets and all of their earnings and everything they have altogether equals what six people in the Walton family own too. And you could go on like this forever. There's something like 80 or 90% of the wealth of the United States is equaled by something like 200 people that own, you know, that have gigantic fortunes, like Bloomberg, the Duke of New York, right? Here, let's see. Here's a report that was on Internet. You want to find out a lot about this kind of stuff. Alternet is the best place to go. Go to Alternet whenever you want to get these things and sign up for notices from them. They'll send you the headlines and articles. It's really the best place. And this is an article called Seven Ultra-Rich Companies Rake in Profits While Paying Workers Peanuts. Just recently, Caterpillar, a gigantic international builder of, you know, farm and earth-moving equipment and construction equipment, Caterpillar announced their last year's profit was $4 billion. $4 billion profit after all their expenses. And what are they doing? They are cutting the pensions for workers, and they are cutting salaries for workers. All right. Let's see. July 24th marks 3 years since the last time the federal minimum wage went up. The federal minimum wage right now is $7.25 an hour. $7.25 an hour. If you work 40 hours, that's $290 a week. That's less than $15,000 a year if they give you a couple of weeks off. $15,000 a year? That means you're in poverty. So the minimum wage that the owners and proprietors of America, i.e. the rich people and their hirelings in Congress and in the White House, they'll let you have $7.25, and you'll work your ass off, and they'll yell at you, and they make the work conditions less safe than they were 50 years ago, and they'll insult you, and they'll take away your pension, and they'll take away any health benefits if they feel like doing it. And the unions are useless because either they've been bribed and weakened over the last few decades, or the companies can just outsource all the work. And if they can't outsource it, there's always an army of other poor people that they will put in there if you don't want the job. $7.25 an hour, and there have been movements in various states. Now, it varies by company and by state, but the average minimum wage in this country is something like $8.95 an hour. You can't live on that. Anybody who's a grown-up or even a student knows that you can't live on that. Do you want to be roomies with four people in your building or on your block? Probably not. Why should you have to be? Bloomberg and McCain and Romney have something like 28 houses, mansions, between those three guys. They could house 1,000 people comfortably. Meanwhile, they would like you all to double up or triple up or quadruple up because that's all you can make. Of the 50 largest employers of low-wage workers, 92% of those were profitable last year, and three-fourths of them are doing better than they were before the recession. In other words, let's see here. Meanwhile, the executives at these companies are pocketing the money that isn't going to their workers. The study that they did found that top executive compensation at those firms averaged over $9 million last year. I can't say the word here. I could say it on satellite, but I can't say the word here. I'm allowed to curse on this station? You sure now? Okay. These motherfuckers are making $9 million a year on average at these corporations. $9 million on average by cheating, stealing, lying, and bribing politicians, and paying $7.50 to the people who pick up garbage, fry chicken, and sweep up in their warehouses. It's wrong. It is as close to the word evil as I can think of. It's wrong. So assuming that they work a 40-hour week, that is, these corporation executives that make $9 million a year, they're getting paid $4,326 an hour. Is that more than you get? It's a little more than I get. $4,326 an hour, which is more than 600 employees make at today's minimum wage. All right? Now, who are these companies? And they list all these companies. One is Toys R Us, which, guess what, is owned by Bain Capital. Toys R Us, with the happy giraffe, come and make your child's life wonderful. Toys R Us stores closed shortly after Bain took over. 75 Toys R Us stores closed shortly after Bain Capital took over, putting some 2,250 people out of work. It's not just the workers laid off by Toys R Us who are suffering. According to a new report from the United New York and the Alliance for a Greater New York, most Toys R Us workers in one of the country's most expensive and most unequal cities, that's New York, make less than $10 an hour. You cannot live on that. You cannot find a decent place to live or even hardly eat on that. Now, the head of Toys R Us makes, let's see. All right, so Toys R Us has had problems complying with labor laws, including child labor laws. It paid a $200,000 fine to the Department of Labor in 1999 after an investigation found more than 300 underage workers working longer hours than allowed by law. And pretty incredible, it says here, for a company whose vision statement is, this is what Toys R Us' vision statement is, our vision is to put joy in kids' hearts and smile on parents' faces. They're the ones who have child labor and are paying people $10 an hour, barely. Meanwhile, Gerald Storch, the CEO of Toys R Us, took in $7.9 million in total compensation in 2011, which is a $5.2 million increase from the previous year. He lives in an 11,000-square-foot home on 2 acres in New Jersey. He bought the house for $3.4 million in 2006, the year he took over as CEO, et cetera, et cetera. Walmart, I already told you about it. Walmart is by far the country's largest low-wage employer, with a U.S. workforce of 1,400,000 people. Last year, its highest-paid executive took home $18.1 million, or $9,066 an hour. The Walton family, and I mentioned that before, let's see, they have... they have as much wealth between them, six people in that family, as 48.8 million American families, the bottom 48.8 million. Con Ed pays people $8 an hour to dig up the streets, to get filthy and dirty, to take health risks, to keep the electricity going. They pay people $8 an hour to lay cable, to do maintenance work. The CEO of Con Ed last year made $11 million a year. And I could go on and on and on, but I won't. Bottom line is that we're living in a place that has been stolen by rich people. They occupy the White House. They occupy Congress. They are like some kind of alien creature, these corporations, which have invaded what look like human beings. And they're like the, you know, the little pods. Every congressperson has an office. In each one of these, and senator, and in the White House, and in the Oval Office, there are these strange pods growing in the corner. You can't see them because you're not allowed to go in their offices, right? They have pods growing in the corner. The pods were constructed and built by and put in there by corporations and by rich people. In these pods are exact reproductions of the congresspeople and the senators and the president. Did you ever look at these people and say, they can't be really saying that? That doesn't seem real. How could they do a thing like that to other people? That doesn't even look real. You know why? Because they're not real. They're actually imitations of human beings who have actually since died. They're just pod people for corporations. And so what they want us to do, they argue with each other, and people on MSNBC, and people write op-ed pieces, and people campaign all over the place, and they make speeches everywhere, and they say, my opponent, really? I don't want to get all Zen on you here, but you know what? The Zen people really have it. They really have a good idea when they talk about a lack of duality, that duality is an illusion. You know, in Zen, without going through a lot of explanations here, they say that the secret of things is that you only imagine that you are separate from other people, or separate from a tree you're looking at, or you're separate from evil, or you're separate from good, or separate from anything. No, you are it. It is you. And it is the ultimate religion to understand connectedness, that we are all part of each other, right? And yet what'll happen, you have two presumably separate political parties, right? And they yell at each other, and they say, my opponent, and they fight with each other. Campaign battles, they call it. They use all warfare terms, right? And it's just a gigantic illusion perpetrated by corporations and rich people, probably in back rooms deliberately with these candidates, to deceive you into thinking there's a difference between them. I'll say it again. And let me be more complex and slightly more mature about this. Do I think Obama is better than Romney? Yes, I do. Do I think he's done more good for more people? Yes, I do. Look at his Supreme Court appointments. There's a lot of people, this watered-down, lobby-ridden corporate gift called the Affordable Care Act is better than what Romney would do, who would have no help for anybody who was suffering or poor or needed more. He wouldn't cover anybody's insurance. What does he care? He's building a carport in his house that's going to cost more than the average American's salary per year to lift his cars up to a higher level when he needs to drive out someplace because they've got four or five or six cars in just the one house. So basically they have this, they give you the illusion that there's a separation between the two of them. And they yell at each other. They campaign, my opponent. And if he gets in, it'll be a disaster. And if the other one says, if he gets in, it'll be a disaster. If either one of them gets in, the disaster will continue. The disaster will continue. And so no need to make this point over and over again. The rich have stolen our country. They own all the politicians. If you think that voting for a Democrat or a Republican is going to make any difference, you're living in a daydream. George Carlin says, they said, they call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. Right? It's a dream. They're duping you. They're lying to you. And they're laughing all the way literally to the bank. Okay? So what do we do about this? What do we do about this? There's all kinds of things you could do. Let's start with the most extreme thing. We can have a violent revolution. We once had a violent revolution in this country and threw out the British, who were tyrants. And we had to fight a war, a bloody, horrible war. And believe me, if you have any idea, you have no idea unless you've read in detail about it, what an awful war that was. How many innocent people got killed and bayoneted by mercenaries on the British side. The British hung people. They burned down houses. They killed prisoners. Everybody was a traitor to them. And they couldn't care less because, as usual in most places, the scum of each country joined the army. They had nothing better to do. It wasn't that they didn't have jobs necessarily, but they wanted adventure. They wanted to get away from their home life. They wanted to get three squares a day. Maybe, yeah, maybe they were poor over there. Sure. And they get to go all over the world, wear uniforms, stab people and shoot people, and lord it over the rest of the earth. So they come here, and they bane at people, and they hang people, and everybody is a traitor as far as they're concerned, right? And they burn things down. And so we had a revolution for that. You know, we had a violent revolution. It's an extraordinary thing. It went on for 5 years. We fought with these people, and it brought incredible suffering to this country, right? But we fought for it. Now, we could actually go to these people's mansions and arrest them all and throw them in people's prisons and take everything they have, sell it, and then use the houses and subdivide the houses and put the homeless in there, or put people who are underwater in their mortgages, people who have been dispossessed by banks. We could take all those people. If we took the top 10,000 richest people in the world and all the houses they own and all the land, and we could take all their money away and leave them with just enough to get by, you know, maybe give them a job as a janitor, see how they like it. Bloomberg, what if he could sweep up City Hall instead of actually occupying his own house? Maybe we could sell his mansion on 79th Street in Manhattan and put people in it to live there who are suffering, who he allows to suffer by being friends with the bankers. The bankers do not. Goldman Sachs got a visit from the mayor. During the height of the Occupy movement, Bloomberg went down to Zuccotti Park. And who did he go down there? He went down to give a pep talk and to cheer up the workers at Goldman Sachs. This son of a bitch. Right? This pig, who, thank God, is probably coming to a dead end politically, but he still wields tremendous power because he has billions of dollars. Okay, so the worst extreme is we actually take away their offices, we take away their buildings, we take away their money, and we either lock them up because of what they did to us, we sell everything they own, which we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, pay off debts, resume living in our houses, raise the minimum wage to $25 an hour, or maybe there shouldn't even be a minimum wage. You know, personally, I'm for nationalizing everything. I'm for complete socialism. Take it all away from them, and if they resist, lock them up, okay? And now, obviously, we can't do that. It's against the law. We'll all get shot down and locked up, you know, if we attempt to do it. And you don't want to do things like that, really, if you could do it any other way. Why? Look at the French Revolution. When you use extreme violence, and I'm not excusing what they did, you know, I'm not apologizing or excusing one way or the other. I suppose if you lived in France, you know, in the 1780s, You're treated like dirt, and you're, you know, raped and murdered, and you don't have enough to eat, and your kids are dying by people who have eight palaces. So shoot them, you know, cut them up, shoot them with muskets, you know, chop their heads off and take everything they have and give it away. But if you use violence, to take it away from them, then what happens when violence happens in a revolution? And even in the Occupy movement, if violence occurs during a revolution, like in the Russian Revolution, but especially the French Revolution and in other revolutions, look what happened in Libya and in Syria. When there's violence in a revolution, the worst people, the craziest people, the most loony, vicious, stronger, immoral, and organized crazy people will take over. And that's exactly what happens in a lot of revolutions. You want to have a peaceful revolution if you can. Now, as shareholders of the United Corporations of America, we could try to vote to reform the corporation. Well, in the two-party system we have, and the way votes work and the way campaigns are bought, that's a useless joke. We could use bank deposits. We have trillions of dollars on deposit in banks, all of us little sheep voters. We could move that money, and some people are doing it but not enough, out of those big banks and put it in smaller middle-level banks that don't cheat and steal from people. The big thing would be civil disobedience and boycotts. This has worked in other places. We even did it in this country for specific industries and for specific reasons. It worked in the whole world against South Africa. Massive civil disobedience. I'm talking about like general strikes, stopping the whole damn thing, sitting in front of every single bank, every single investment house, the headquarters of every place, going to the Walton's house, wherever these Walton families live, wherever the head of the CEOs of all these companies live, going to where they actually live, publishing their addresses on the internet, sitting in front day and night, 24 hours a day, on their street, in the public streets, or on their lawns, and getting arrested in the thousands until somebody finally gets it, right? But and then there's boycotts. We can just stop using their banks and go to there are other banks, right? And there are consumer credit unions. We can stop buying these products. But this brings up another problem. Are Americans willing to alter the way they live? Will people give up their air conditioners and televisions? And I'm in the crowd, too, and I'm asking this question out loud. Do we have the guts and do we have the ability to change our actual way of life, to change our culture? Will we stop consuming so much? Will we stop buying all this trash that we don't need? I don't know. The prognosis is not so good. There's always a new gadget. There's a better TV. There's a better computer you can buy. There's something new for the kitchen. There's another gadget. You can buy this. You can go to that restaurant. Really, do you need to do that? No. Yeah. You don't need to do that. You don't need to do it. But easier said than done. How fast am I going to stop doing the things I do? I consume not so much, believe me, not compared to a lot of people, but still it's more than I need. So that's another way to do it. But then mass civil disobedience really is the only thing left, as Gandhi did in India. You just sit in front of the – you don't let fracking trucks drive back and forth to wells all over the country and destroy the land and poison the aquifers. You sit on the roads in front of the trucks. You surround the places where they do this. You go to auctions where they're bidding off our land to private corporations, and you make fake bids so that the whole auction is destroyed, as somebody did about a year ago, and they sent him to jail for it. You boycott. You sit in. Hundreds of thousands of people will be arrested, but finally it'll get to be too much. Even the soldiers and even the cops have to earn a living. They won't be able to see their own families and their own children and their own brothers and sisters get clubbed and bayoneted and arrested. It won't happen. That's the only thing that's going to be left to do. We have to take this country back. Voting, unless you vote for a third-party candidate, and that's not good. They're not going to get elected. I know it, you know it, and they know it. Unless you vote for them, you're voting for the same old thing. You want to vote for a Democrat or Republican? You're voting for the same thing, the same corporation, the same person. You're wasting your vote. Vote for a third-party candidate like Jill Stein from the Green Party, Rocky Anderson from the Justice Party. Make your vote count, and I mean that, by voting for somebody who you feel has real integrity, who stands for what you stand for. Use your conscience when you vote. Be an American. Don't be a sheep. Don't vote for the lesser of two evils. We got to get together and have massive civil disobedience and vote for third parties, or we're just as doomed as we look like we are.